My first guest today is writer Loretta Hall of Albuquerque, and coming up in the second half is the amazing Diana Dowling for Speaking of the Arts. So stay tuned. Welcome, Loretta.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Loretta has written hundreds of magazine articles and 5 nonfiction books on topics ranging from space exploration to ecological architecture and multiculturalism. Her book, Out of This World, New Mexico's Contributions to Space Travel, won 3 awards, and her most recent book, Space Pioneers, in their own words, won the science category of the 2014 New Mexico Arizona Book Awards and was named Best Book of the Contest.
What a thrill.
No kidding. And that I met Loretta recently in an event and heard all about her book and thought, I've got to have her on the show. So I'm really glad you're here. Tell us how you got interested in space exploration.
Was in 1959 when the Mercury 7 astronauts were introduced to the country, and I thought that was just fabulous. I followed the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs avidly. And then several years ago when I heard that the world's first purpose-built commercial spaceport was going to be built here in New Mexico, that really reinvigorated that interest and got me started investigating why New Mexico was chosen for that very unique facility, and I found out all sorts of wonderful things about New Mexico and space.
And so how did this particular book, Space Pioneers, come about?
Well, when I was researching the first space history book, I did some of my research at the New Mexico Museum of Space History in Alamogordo, and they were very gracious in giving me access to their archives, and I discovered that they have been doing an oral history project since 1985, interviewing people who were involved in various space-related programs from 1945 up through pretty much the current day. And these interviews have been transcribed, and they sit there in a locked filing cabinet in an area that's not accessible to the public. And I thought, what a wonderful resource that this should be available to more people. And so I asked if I could use those for the basis of a new book, and that's what I did.
So you spent a lot of time in Alamogordo.
Yes.
Did you actually spend time there reading those things? Surely you didn't copy 300 different interviews.
Well, no, they had about 140 at that time, and I selected 90 of them to actually include in my book. And they had some of them had been digitized, and then I scanned the others and digitized them and worked with them that way.
Mm-hmm. And so what were your criteria for selecting the people that you wanted to include in the book?
Mostly that it was really related to space travel. Some of them were more tangential than I was interested in. And then also just their voices and the kinds of experiences that they were sharing that I found fascinating. You know, some of them are just laugh out loud funny. Some of them are just really horrific. And others are just in between somewhere, but all of them are just really interesting.
And you structured the book in an interesting way. Tell the listeners about that.
Well, rather than just putting one interview after another, I tried to organize it topic-wise and more or less chronologically moving through the book. So the couple of early chapters just set the scene of what it was like to work on early space programs in general, and then moving into sort of the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo era, and then into the space shuttle era.
So, I mean, we're going to have you talk about some specific people here, but can you sort of characterize for people what it was like in general to work on those early space missions?
Much more commonplace than people would realize. You know, they found all sorts of innovative ways to get by on low funding, did a lot of scrapping around and improvising. It was just very, and they were ordinary people. They were not anybody really special. They just, for one reason or another, happened into that career and figured out how to put man on the moon.
Mm-hmm. I was taken by how many, you know, we think about the space program. Of course, we always think about the astronauts.
Right.
And we don't think about all of those people working, you know, in the flight control and all the, you know, the little people, so to speak, who make such an enormous project work. Mm-hmm. And some of those people are in the book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I was also struck by just how chaotic the whole thing was. You know, we would like to think that something as serious as the space program was all completely and perfectly well organized and everyone knew their job and what they were doing, but no one had done those jobs before.
Exactly.
And they didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
And so it was sort of trying and failing and trying and failing and trying and failing, and the borrowing of employees from other divisions and other departments and begging, borrowing, and stealing the things that they needed.
Pretty much.
Yeah, to make things happen. So, and I was thrilled, of course, to read the stories of a few women.
Right. There are half a dozen women in the book, and they go back all the way to the 1945 time period and up through the space shuttle.
So who would you like to tell us about first?
Well, one of my favorites is Cynthia Somers Guzevich. And this is one person that I actually had the pleasure of meeting in person and talking with. And she was born in Munich, Germany. When she was almost 19 years old, she was training to be an artist. And then she was pressed into service for the Nazi government, as everyone was in Germany at that time. And she actually had an uncle who was a friend of Hitler's. He was not a Nazi, but he pulled some strings and made it possible for her to have some voice in what kind of work she would be doing. And so she ended up in engineering, and for a while, unbeknownst to her, was working on the V-2 rocket engine.
Hmm.
And then after the war, she married an American serviceman and came to this country. And after a while, our government figured out that she'd been working on the V-2 program. And they brought her to White Sands Proving Ground and transferred her husband to Holloman Air Force Base. And she was working there on the V-2s that were brought from Germany and working for the Americans on the V-2s. And then she also, later on, excuse me, at White Sands. She was also a dog, excuse me, a dog trainer and dog show judge. And she got into a program where she and her husband worked with trained dogs to recover experiments from suborbital flights of unmanned rockets. And
so I want to make clear that she and her husband were raising dogs on their own, just for fun, showing mm-hmm. them. And then when her superiors found out what she was doing, there was this idea that she could train dogs to do this recovery.
Well, they didn't actually train the dogs. A man in Maryland trained them, but then they trained Cynthia and her husband on how to handle the dogs out in the field. And they worked on that program for several years, and it was highly successful.
And fascinating, the stories about how many people didn't believe the dogs were capable of doing these things.
Right.
And over and over and over again, the dogs would prove them wrong. They would send out, there was one guy in particular who thought, you know, he sent out 100 soldiers or something to find this piece that had fallen, right? And they never did, but the dogs did.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Do you want to read something from?
I'd like to just make this one point from Cynthia. She said, White Sands is old history. People don't know what we did out there. They don't know that we were the kindergarten of the space programs. With this V-2 program, you really knew that you were involved in the beginning of the space program. Life at White Sands was very casual, fun in a way. I remember one time when I was stopped by an MP because I was speeding, and when I said something to him, he said, "Oh, you're one of the Germans. We're not supposed to give you tickets because they all have their minds in the clouds."
So she got away with no ticket.
Right.
Yeah, I after reading that, I thought, now there's a job that no one would guess, you know, her work with the dogs, that no one would ever guess was involved with the space program.
Right.
Yeah. And who else? What about Dr. William Douglas, the Air Force flight surgeon?
He was a fascinating person. He was named to be the personal physician for the Mercury 7 astronauts, and he went through and participated in some of the training that they participated in and was involved really intimately with them and the program. And he tells a story, one of the humorous stories in the book, about a time when Scott Carpenter had just finished a training run on a centrifuge, and they
who is Scott Carpenter for our younger listeners?
Scott Carpenter was one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts.
Okay,
and so after this training exercise, Scott went in to take a shower, and Dr. Douglas went into the office to write up his report, and all of a sudden he heard this crash from the shower room, and he was startled, and he ran in there, and Scott Carpenter was laid out with his eyes closed on the floor with the water running, and he was just in a panic. Oh my gosh, we've lost one of our astronauts, and he reached down to help Scott up, and then Scott couldn't contain himself any longer and burst out laughing. It was all a joke. So there was a lot of fun involved, too.
It was interesting to me that one of the things that he did do, this Dr. Douglas undertook, he did as many tests as he could do with the astronauts. So as many of the experimental things they were doing to the astronauts to make sure they could respond appropriately in space or how their bodies physiologically would respond to certain stresses, he did as many as he could himself.
Right.
And so because of that, he had great credibility with them.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't just, and great credibility throughout the whole system, because he wasn't just saying these things. He'd actually done a lot of them himself.
Right.
Yeah. So that was a big difference. And also, but one of the things he said in there that shocked me to death, I'm sure is no longer true, is that there was no psychological testing for the people who became astronauts.
That's right. They wanted them, well, they wanted them to be able to respond in their own way. You know, he told, I think it was he that told a story about psychologists that were interviewed by a reporter prior to selecting the astronauts, the first astronauts, and they said, you know, what kind of people should be chosen for this? And one psychologist said, well, they should be Eskimos, because they live way up there in the north, and they're used to long periods of sun and then long periods without sun, and so orbiting the Earth and putting them wouldn't put them off schedule as much. And the other psychologist said, well, they should be Buddhist monks, because they can put themselves into a trance and not experience this horrible isolation and terrifying experience. And fortunately, cooler heads prevailed, and they went with military test pilots.
who were to a certain extent, you know, flight cowboys.
Yeah.
What would you call them? Pilot cowboys. You know, they were these, yeah, these, you know, really tough, right stuff kind of guys.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they knew how to follow orders, mm-hmm. but they also knew how to avoid hearing orders that they didn't necessarily want to follow.
Right. I'm talking with Loretta Hall, the author of Space Pioneers, In Their Own Words, a wonderful book that's already won a lot of awards recently out. Let's talk about Jean Kranz.
Jean Kranz was an absolutely fascinating person, and another individual that I had the opportunity to meet in person. And he was...
So wait, let's stop. In addition to using the transcribed oral histories of these many people who were involved in the space program, you also got to interview some of them yourself.
A few.
Uh-huh. Some of them are still able to be.
Yeah, right.
And so who was Jean Kranz?
Well, he was a flight director throughout the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs. And so he was, if people have seen the Tom Hanks movie, Apollo 13, Jean Kranz was the guy in the white vest. So
he played by Ed Harris, I think,
exactly.
Right?
Uh-huh. And he talks in his interview about how they prepared Ed Harris to do that part, and how, for the most part, accurately portrayed
mm-hmm.
him.
Mm-hmm. I think the only thing he said, Ed Harris, that they put in the movie that wasn't accurate was that there's this one scene where Ed Harris blew up.
Right.
And Jean Kranz said, you know, you could never do that.
Exactly.
You could never lose your cool as a flight controller and
right.
director. And in reading about this, I was fascinated by, you know, just the realization that this one guy had the weight of the world on his shoulders. Mm-hmm. Because even though it was a huge team approach, he was the one, you know, the buck stopped with him.
Exactly.
Every decision made, you know, especially in various circumstances that were really, really critical to the lives of the astronauts and things. And yeah, so tell us some more about him.
Well, one of the interesting things there, I thought, was that by the time we were ready to launch Apollo 11, which was going to be the first mission that would actually land men on the moon, his team, you know, they'd been through Mercury, Gemini, and several other Apollo launches, And so they really felt like they knew their stuff. They were Super Bowl quality. And so in their final training exercise, their simulation supervisor, usually the final training exercise was just kind of a fluff
pro
graduation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he thought they were a little too cocky, so he threw them a real challenge with a computer malfunction. And they didn't know how to handle it. And they made the wrong decision. Mm-hmm. And that really alerted them to the fact they needed to understand those computer alarms much better. They worked very hard on it. And as luck would have it, during the Apollo 11 flight, exactly that problem occurred. And they handled it very easily because they were well prepared.
Yeah, no kidding. What an amazing and strange coincidence that that happened, and that they were prepared.
Well, and even if it had been a different problem, they had figured out how to analyze the computer alarms in a better way, and they would have been able to handle it even if it had been a slightly different problem.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that struck me about that, what Gene had to say also, I mean, I almost just, my jaw dropped when he said, you know, the thing you have to remember is how young this crew was, how young we all were. And when he was the flight director on Apollo 11, it might have been Apollo 13, I don't remember, he was 37 years old, and he was the oldest person on the project.
Right. The average age in mission control at that time, I think, was 26 or 28.
Yeah. Can you imagine handing over a project of that scope and cost and you know, I mean, the risk of so many lives as well to some group of people so young.
Right. And I remember he talked about the first time they put a computer on board one of the spacecraft, I think it was in the Gemini era, and it was a 4-kilobyte computer, and none of them knew how to handle it.
4 kilobytes. Love that. Do you want to read something else?
Well, in talking about that computer alarm during the Apollo 11 flight, he says that in the final moments, I think it was about, oh, excuse me, this is the Apollo 13 flight.
Okay.
Where they had the explosion on the way to the moon and disabled the spacecraft. The third step was the final moment, I think it was about 12 minutes after the explosion, when Lovell looks outside the hatch and he says, "Hey, Houston, I see some kind of gaseous substance out there. I believe we are venting something," and this immediately triggered survival. As I went through those 10 to 12 minutes, it was just frustration because we couldn't wrap our arm around it. All of a sudden, the direction was clear. Basically, this is where I call the controllers and say, "Okay, flight controllers, settle down. Quit your guessing. Let's start working this problem. Electrical bus A is still good. Don't do anything to screw it up. The lunar mod is attached. We're going to use that as our lifeboat. Now give me some backup people in here and get me more computing and communication resources." So that was the point where all of a sudden the issue became one of survival. The focus was clear, and now the team could get to work.
Wow.
High drama.
High drama is true. You know, we're so used to seeing on television high drama with police shows and high drama with fire shows and even high drama in hospital ICUs and operating rooms. But just thinking about what that must have been like and the adrenaline that must have been going on in that room. If there were some sort of magic light by which you could measure that, you know, it would have, the whole room would have turned red.
Yes. Well, and there was one other person whose interview is in the book, and he was actually, I think, a personnel officer. He was not a technical person, but they sort of rotated them in so they could have a little experience in mission control, and he happened to be in mission control on one of the monitors when the Apollo 13 crisis came up, and he had to actually help work through that problem, and that was a really an amazing experience for him.
Wow, no kidding. Join the team. Go ahead right now. So let's hear about Eileen Collins. We've got a little bit of time left.
Okay.
Here.
Eileen Collins was a real groundbreaking female in first the Air Force and then in the space shuttle program. And she was She became one of the early female flight instructors in the Air Force and then got into the space shuttle program. She became the first female pilot of the space shuttle and later the first female commander of a space shuttle. And the commander is actually the one who lands the space shuttle. People think the pilot does, but it's actually the commander. So she was really a groundbreaker. And she said, you know, that she took this role seriously, that she wanted to just do a good job so that other women following her would not be at a disadvantage. And that was her main focus. She just wanted to do a good job. And she said that was easy in NASA because they were open to that.
She was very, it was very altruistic. You know, she didn't want to screw up. She said that many times
right.
in that interview. She really wanted to lay the groundwork. So, because she didn't want anybody to point to her and say, well, look at, she screwed up so bad. You know, we're not hiring another woman.
Exactly.
And her narration was very interesting because it was an extremely detailed, specific story of how she got where she was.
Right.
And most of the time, she didn't have any problem with the men because once they found out what her skills were, nobody gave her any trouble. She had one interaction with a Saudi Arabian pilot that was in training with
right.
the U.S. that, and she tried to tell her superiors, he will not want to be in a plane with me because of his religious beliefs about, and cultural beliefs about contact with women.
Right.
And they wouldn't listen to her. They assigned him to her anyway, and then he went and said to them, no, I'm not doing this. And that wasn't personal at all. It
right.
was, you know, it was a cultural thing. But, and the other thing that she said that I didn't see, and I have not read the whole book, obviously, it's about 2 inches thick, but was that she was the person of these, of the ones that I read, who talked about the beauty of the Earth from space
mm-hmm.
and how she envisioned how important space travel could be for environmentalists trying to track changes on the planet. Now, was that prescient or not, thinking
right.
about climate change and seeing, like, the oceans and what's happening and things like that?
And several other people had that same reaction.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right. Well, we're about out of time, Loretta. I've been talking with Loretta Hall, the author of Space Pioneers in Their Own Words. It's a fascinating book of oral histories of those who've made our space program a success.